Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm with Erica C. Barnett, who writes for the C is for Crank.com. Zeki Hamid, Program Director at Humanities Washington. Welcome.
Hello.
Did I say hi, Erica? Hi.
You did not.
Nice to see you. Snug up to that microphone there. And Seattle used to have a mayor named Mike McGinn, and he sits before you now, hosting the podcast You, Me, Us Now. Hey, Mayor.
It sounds like you've done this before, Bill.
I've done it a few times. Yeah, thank you. Can we talk about the top stories of the week and figure out what we can learn and what they're really about?
Go for it.
Okay, so number one, Seattle police want a new precinct building in North Seattle, 130th and Aurora. It's expensive. $149 million is the latest figure, with an amphitheater and gardens and a skate park and a bunch of other things. And the city included amenities like these, partly in response to complaints that the police department lacks humanity. But Seattle Weekly reporter Casey Jaywork told me that all the bells and whistles have not placated protesters who say this building rewards a racist, violent police force with an expensive paramilitary bunker.
This really speaks to the disconnect between sort of what I saw coming from the council and members of the city government who support this versus activists who oppose it. It really gets to this issue of, like, how radical a change do we need to address the problems of policing in this country? If you're more sort of conventional and reformist and taking the line that a lot of city council has taken, the problem that we're facing is basically that we need police and community members to be nicer to each other and just get along and hug it out, almost. And if that's the sort of frame that you're working from, then it makes sense that if you make a nicer police station that's more welcoming to the community, then you can deal with the problem of divisions between police and the community. On the other hand, if you're one of the Black Lives activists who's critiquing this on a much deeper level and saying, no, the problem isn't that we don't get along. The problem is that this is an occupying force that is descended from slave catchers who is here to kill us.
What to make of this police station building and all the issues around it? Former Mayor McGinn, this building project started under your watch. What do you think of it now?
I think it's just the cost has spiraled completely out of control. And I think there's a really fundamental point that's being raised about priorities by many of the protesters. With all of the needs of this city, you know, how does $160 million get allocated to this one project? I may recall our current mayor, Ed Murray, went on TV to say we didn't have more money for homeless. We had to declare an emergency and get money from other places.
Yeah, but I had read some city council members acting like that's not really how it works. You know, you can't compare. We should spend money on this and not that. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. This is capital dollars that could be used to build housing, could be used to build sidewalks, could be used to repair potholes, could be used for any number of capital needs across the city. And this precinct is going to soak up a lot of the boom time revenue that we're facing right now. And budgets are moral documents. They're prioritization documents. So I look at this idea that they're going to ask for a racial equity toolkit analysis of the precinct. What really needs to be analyzed here is the racial and social equity of the city budget. And the city council can't outsource that. They've got to do that. That's their job. So when you say $160 million for a new police precinct, most expensive precinct anywhere, and we can't even talk about those dollars, and meanwhile you're telling social services, you know, homeless, sidewalk advocates, everybody else, we don't have dollars for you. You know, the council has to accept that responsibility. Is it too much money or not? And I'm sure there's lots of nice things in there. You know, there's lots of things I'd love to do with my house, too. But you have to have the money to do it. And there is, in fact, a prioritization process that has to occur. So the issue here is, how did the police get to soak up all the dollars in our society? That's the fundamental question and a very important one.
Okay, price tags matter. What's your take on this, Erica?
Well, I agree that price tags matter. And I think the $149 million they're now saying it would cost is too high. But I think, you know, first of all, I don't agree that all dollars are fungible and that, I mean, we have a city budget and it can just be spent however. the details of it, you know, I haven't dug into exactly where all this money is coming from or supposedly going to come from. But I think it's a flawed analysis to say, and it's a conversation stopper that is always used whenever the city council makes a budget decision that some people don't like, is, you know, that, oh, well, that could be spent elsewhere. I think we should be looking.
Well, let's start there. Why isn't that a legitimate argument?
The bulk of the dollars for this will probably come from real estate excise taxes. And real estate excise taxes can be used under state law for any capital, for many capital improvements.
But without getting too budgety, I mean, this question of, is it fair to say you're spending money on this that could have gone to this?
I tend to believe it's always fair because because legislatures and budget makers, and I had to deal with very deep budget cuts. You know, there are ways to get monies from one account to the other or to change the rules.
Well,
that is the job of the legislators.
I seem to recall, I mean, you resisting, you know, moving money from one place to another on similar grounds. I just think that, you know, it's easy for people who are sitting outside the process to complain about this. And it's also easy for people sitting inside the process to say, oh, no, it's impossible. So there are flaws to both arguments. But I think there a different argument should be happening, which is, as you said, Mayor McGinn, about prioritization. I think getting upset about things like so-called yoga studios, which are really just, you know, meeting rooms.
It's a room.
Right.
Lots of things can happen.
Rooms are not in themselves expensive. You know, running tracks. I'm fine with our police being in good shape. You know, things like that. Those aren't really the big cost drivers here. The cost drivers are things like the training facility, which is, by the way, being mandated by the DOJ as part of the getting out from under the consent decree. Another big cost driver is the $27 million parking garage that is barely being questioned, so that in contradiction to the city's own commute trip reduction goals, police officers can drive their private cars up to the station and park every single day. And I think that is a cost that should be cut. There are tons of surface parking lots in that area that the city can rent if the police department refuses to adhere to the same goals that the rest of the city has adopted to not drive alone so much. And talk about exceptionalism. The police department says that they can't possibly do that because, you know, they can't possibly change their commute patterns because police are different, because they are uniquely endangered in their own private cars driving to work, that they work strange hours when transit just doesn't run. And I think that's a place that we should be examining the excuses that the police department and the city is making for building this huge parking garage, and think about cutting that back, because that $27 million is a lot of money and it could go a long way towards other purposes.
Okay, so we've talked about money. We've talked about parking. We have not really talked at all about race and bunkers and paramilitary forces. There's just so much going on with this proposed new police station we're talking about. Zeki?
Yeah, so I completely understand the visceral anger that communities of color are expressing here, and because they're expressing it towards a system that has continually failed them. Every time we get a DOJ report from some police station around the country, it just makes you ashamed to be a part of this, be a part of an American, that this is still happening here. This is absolutely shameful. The last DOJ report that just came out from Baltimore just makes you sick to your stomach. So I understand where that is, where that anger comes from, because the Black Lives Matter, you know, folks, right now, they're not just protesting a building. They're protesting a system. And that's where the problem lies. So I completely understand where they're coming from, because what needs to be reformed is policing systems, not just building. We're not talking about just money or anything like that. There is a deep, deep problem between communities of color and police.
And why focus those frustrations on this? We're talking about a proposed building. You know, the specific case.
Because the building represents that system. I don't think they're really angry about a building. They're angry about a system. Mm-hmm. Now, but if I may, and like on the other hand, North Seattle could really benefit from increased police. I live around that area, and I travel the 99 corridor every single day. And not a single day goes by that I don't see, you know, prostitutes, drug dealing, people shouting obscenities. And when it really starts to upset me is when they go into the playgrounds. Because if I'm taking my kid to a playground, I don't want that to be there. And I see it almost every day, every time I take my daughter there. So I understand that there is a need for increased policing. I'm not sure this is the way or not, but it's a dilemma. I don't think there are any easy answers to it.
I think Erica was getting at some of that when she was talking about the parking garage, frankly. It's kind of that understood. It's just understood by all the decision makers that police officers should be allowed to drive and have a free parking space at work in a way that does not extend to any other city worker. And that sense of accommodation is not granted. You know, there's a horrific article in the Seattle Times this morning about the sweeps policy and what that's doing to people. And one set of constituents, the police officers, are getting this incredible free amenity no other city worker gets. And another set of constituents can't even, you know, they're told there's no money for you. That is the structural class and race issue of city spending that just is generated without any person trying to generate that outcome.
But are they?
That is the definition of structural racism. That is it. We're seeing it in front of us with $160 million for this structure.
Are the police currently in a structure that is too crowded or too small? Does the city want to give them? Would you want to give them a building that is earthquake proof and I suppose theoretically bomb proof? I mean, because eventually it's getting down to whatever you think of the police. They do a lot of things, including protect and serve. So
sure. And in fact, I did in fact start this process because the old precinct was mm-hmm. due for an upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, you know, through bureaucratic inertia, through probably some politics as well. You know, the executive branch and the council is asking the police to make a whole bunch of changes for one reason. Let's just give them their precinct, just like we gave them their new uniforms and gave them all SUVs. Let's not fight them over here. And fundamentally, what you discover and what I discovered in office and anybody who looks at it closely, spending doesn't follow race and social justice. It follows power. And that's what it's following here. And that's what's so upsetting to the activists.
I think some of the response that the activists got at city council the other day was really tone deaf, and I think that's part of the problem.
What do you mean by tone deaf?
Well, I mean, Bruce Harrell made a good point, which is that sometimes you need to build a police station. But I think he made it in such a way, you know, sort of yelling at them that they need to have respect. And, you know, you're sitting up there at the dais and you're yelling, you know, or sort of barking commands down at people. And the fact that, you know, that Bruce Harrell is Black and that Deborah Juarez, another city council member, is Native American doesn't, you know, entirely mitigate the fact that they're telling these folks basically, you know, sit down and be quiet. Juarez said, you know, something to the effect of, I know where you're coming from because I grew up, you know, under the yoke of the police and I experienced all this, so I don't need to hear from you. And to me, that was incredibly tone deaf.
She literally say, I don't need to hear from you?
That was
her attitude.
I don't think that was her attitude, actually. I took it in a different way. I took it like, I see you. I know where you're coming from. I'm not just, so I took it the other way.
That's interesting. I took it as somewhat antagonistic. Like,
she also told people not to flip her off.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, there's definitely, you know, a good point saying show some respect is also... It's not a bad point to be making. I'm just saying if I was those protesters, I could see it coming off from their point of view as a little bit flippant and disrespectful and dismissive. So I think the council could have handled it better.
Okay, well, let's pause there then. This is going to continue to be fought over. I mean, the price tag keeps changing. The city's going to study it further. And so we'll keep watching what's going to happen with this proposed new police station in North Seattle at 130th and Aurora. But this leads us right into our next topic, which we also talked about this week, which is the city studying things and the Seattle process. Seattle government is famous or infamous, deservedly or not, for process, that the neighborhood groups fight the city and the mayor fights the city council and the city council deliberates and inclusivizes all the stakeholders and things get done slowly, if at all. That's the knock. Politics editor Josh Feit at Seattle Met Magazine, their politics blog, Publicola, says This is changing. He said, now before I play this, I have to warn you, if you are a former Seattle mayor, you may find this content disturbing.
I've been covering City Hall since 1999. The storyline always was, whether it was Paul Schell in the council, Greg Nichols in the council, Mike McGinn in the council, it was always mayor versus council. And now what you're seeing with this kind of a new process of collaboration, you're seeing them team up and get stuff done.
And what stuff are they getting done? Few examples, $15 minimum wage, upzoning and making developers pay, renter protections, secure scheduling, demoting the neighborhood district councils. Former Mayor Mike McGinn, is the current mayor, Ed Murray, getting stuff done in a way you could not?
Oh, geez. So, you know, it really depends what part of the elephant you touch at any given time. You know, we passed paid sick leave, we increased minority spending on contracting, a library levy, a family and education levy, and there were, in fact, some high-profile differences. I didn't think the tunnel was a good idea, for example. And
that, You don't say.
You don't say. Yeah, that got me into some trouble with the council. But let's take a look at where we are. We have multiple projects way over budget, not just the North Precinct, but the billing system for City Light, I think the 23rd Avenue. You know, you have multiple issues there. Delivering
Seawall,
yeah. Delivering a $160 million precinct proposal to the council. You had people yelling and screaming and, you know, people flipping each other off in the council. Dare I say it, that sounds a little divisive to me. You know, we have homeless people that aren't being taken care of. You know, crime has actually gone up some. Housing, you know, rents continue to go up. And so this issue, it really just depends on what you touch. You can take a look at any part of any administration, and if a council and mayor aren't paying legislation, aren't passing legislation, then they're not doing anything. And you know, I don't want to get into an argument over who got more done, but I don't think that we've replaced politics in the city of Seattle or council mayoral conflicts. In fact, we have another great example now, which is the Uber unionization, where both of them are saying, no, no, after you, you do it first. So I think politics is politics. Sometimes you get things done together, sometimes you fight, and we're seeing the same thing right now.
Erica, Josh Veit does say that, yes, there's a lot to consider, but he sees the arrow going in one direction and says Seattle voters no longer get to be the city's helicopter parents. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I love that metaphor of helicopter parents. I think I want to go back to the neighborhood councils because I think that was actually a good decision by Mayor Murray that was done in a really bad way.
Will you explain that? Catch people up?
Yeah, the city has long had a system of 13 neighborhood district councils, which advise the city on neighborhood planning and decision making. These have been in place since the 90s when we didn't have the internet. They remain in place. It's, you know, a group of people, groups that are dominated by wealthier white homeowners. And if you look at the kind of the difference between homeowners and renters in this city, I mean, it's like they live on two different planets in terms of income, in terms of, you know, their mobility in the city, within the city itself, just in terms of a lot of different factors. So there is a need to overhaul these district councils, and the city is now working on that. But what Mayor Murray did was by executive order remove all their funding, and he did it in a way that that came off as very tone deaf, I think, to the district councils. And they played that up as much as possible. They acted like they hadn't seen it coming. I personally think, you know, having followed this, that's a little disingenuous that they were, you know, completely blindsided.
Let's stay above that fight a little bit.
Anyway,
for this purposes of this discussion,
sure.
We're figuring out how the city is Seattle process.
So that was an executive order, and that is like above the Seattle process. You know, it's saying, you know, I reject this process and I'm going to go above everybody's heads. I think it's going to depend on a couple of things. One is whether the new generation of neighborhood activists who are, you know, more likely to be renters, who are invested in their neighborhoods, you know, who are young parents who came to Seattle in a different time, who were not here in the 60s and don't want Seattle necessarily to be like that. If those people control the direction of the neighborhood movement in the city, I think we're going to see a lot of progress in that direction. And, you know, we're going to see more, you know, more moves towards densification. We're going to see, you know, just a very different city. And that's going to be, you know, a different process than we've seen so far. It also depends on whether, you know, this mayor gets reelected, because I think a lot of it is his personality. He's a legislator. He likes to get things done without a lot of interference from other people, including the city council. You know, and the voters ultimately get to say whether they accept that or reject that sort of way of doing things.
You think his attitude is, move over, legislators. I've been a legislator. I can do this.
A little bit, yeah. I think, you know, with the district councils, this police station may be an example where he backs off. He's backed off on other things in response to neighborhood pressure. So, you know, Murray, in some sense, to a great extent, is pushing through a lot of policies on the force of his own personality. Hmm. And whether that reflects the personality of the city, I think, is gonna remain to be seen.
What do you make of all this, Zeki Hameed?
Well, this process is not really exclusive to Seattle. This is very much a Washington State process. I mean, we love to have our input on every single little thing. I'm not a fan of this process. I like to get things done. As a regular citizen who is not in government, I just want results. And I appreciate the mayor and what he's done. But the thing is, just because these three things got done in a relatively reasonable amount of time doesn't mean this process is gone. It's still in our DNA, and I think we'll still keep going at it. Now, my view of it is I don't like initiative systems. I don't like to have an input on every single little thing. My fight is at the ballot box. So I go, I vote. I've never missed a vote since I became an American. I'm very proud of that. But if you have a problem with something, show up at the ballot box. You either vote them out or you keep them in. And you look at the past election. What was it? I think 34% voter turnout of eligible voters or registered voters. Sorry, 34% of registered voters showed up in the primary to vote. That's abysmal. The process is alive and well, unfortunately.
I think the last word on Seattle process, because we've got to move on, should go to the former mayor.
And I think you should always be very, very careful when all of the elected officials are agreeing with each other on what should be the priorities, because it tends to be the public that then gets left out. That's how you get things like that tunnel project, which most of the electeds agreed on. That's how you get a North Precinct. It's a done deal. We can't reduce the cost now. And, you know, those are the types of prioritization issues that the public should have had a say in instead of just trying to ram it through.
But we voted on the tunnel and the viaduct
But should we get a vote on the North Precinct? $160 million, that's bigger than a lot of levies we voted on.
Erica, you look like you're dying to have the last word. I'm going to give it to you.
I was actually going to give a counterexample or another example where actually the city council sort of subverted the Seattle process in a way that I think is positive. And that's with a lot of these workplace rules. The Carl Hagland Law, my former landlord, which says you have to keep your building up to code or you can't raise rent. The secure scheduling stuff that's going on right now. A lot of that wouldn't get done if you put everything to an endless vote, or maybe it would, but it would be watered down. And I think that the city council is also moving in the direction of not discussing and voting everything to death. And I think that's a positive change.
Listener, I know what you're thinking. You heard the phrase secure scheduling. You're thinking, oh, yeah, I think I know it. I think I know what she's referring to. But I wish I could understand more about it and figure out what's really important that's going on here. We have your back on KUOW's Week in Review. Shall we talk secure scheduling in a moment? And a little governor debate and a little road rage?
Bring it.
Bring it.
Take control, Bill.
Okay, let's do that then. We're live tweeting this show. You know, you can agree or disagree with Zeki Hameed, Program Director at Humanities Washington, Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com, former Mayor Mike McGinn, host of the podcast You, Me, Us Now. I'm Bill Radke, bringing you the Week in Review. This week, the Seattle City Council took public comment on a proposal to make big businesses give their workers more predictable, livable schedules. Employers would have to issue schedules 2 weeks in advance, pay workers for last-minute changes, pay them for being on call, give, I believe, 11 hours is the last I've heard, 11 hours of rest between shifts. The employer would have to offer new shifts, new hours to current employees before hiring new part-timers. The city's labor standards director, Dylan Orr, says predictability is vital to workers.
They know what their schedules are. They can plan their lives, not have last-minute disruptions without getting compensation for those if they didn't actually want those changes to happen. a disproportionate burden is shared by workers of color, foreign-born individuals, and women. So this is a very important issue.
Erica, should we regulate big businesses this way?
Well, I certainly support the idea of giving people some predictability. My question is whether this is the big labor fight to be having, because this only affects, as you said, very large businesses.
500 workers,
yeah,
or more, and restaurants with 500 workers and 40 locations.
Right. And so my concern with this is that the majority of people in Seattle work for small businesses. So when you're looking at companies with more than 500 workers, you're looking at, you know, something like 70% to 80% of workers who are not going to be covered by this law. So my question is, you know, is this grandstanding against Starbucks, or is it, you know, is it the place to be spending a lot of political capital? I mean, if for my money, what I would be, you know, if I was not the mayor, I guess, but the queen, I would be pushing for paid sick leave. I'm sorry, for paid family leave, which we don't have in the city of Seattle. And I think it's, you know, it's absolutely
small businesses, big businesses, all businesses.
I think all businesses should provide paid family leave. I think it's a human rights issue. I think it's a women's rights issue, and I think it would ultimately impact more people than secured scheduling. I also have, you know, my own concerns as the child of franchise owners. You know, I do think that the franchisees raise some potentially legitimate questions about this, because if you have four or five workers, but, you know, you own a Subway, it does become difficult to schedule them. And so I think that, you know, that is a concern that should at least be considered and addressed instead of simply dismissed.
Zeki?
Yeah, I when I first came to the States in 94, and I mean, granted, that was in New York State, but I was in upstate New York and I was working for minimum wage, which back then was $4 and a quarter. And of course, that wasn't really enough, so I needed to get second jobs. And not knowing that the certainty of a schedule was really difficult. If my shift ends on Sunday and I have to wait until that night to figure out what I'm doing the next week, but then I was still a young man at that point, so it wouldn't. So I can still, you know, it was still a little easier for me than it would be for a mom. So I think this is a very good fight. But Erica gives a great point that it's family leave. Leave is really the big fight that should be undertaken right now. But still, it's an innovative way of advocating for workers' rights. So I don't know if they could expend a lot of political capital here, which means you can't expend it somewhere else. I'm not really sure about it, but it's innovative. I support the conversation, at least.
Mayor McGinn, the Washington Retail Association has a bunch of objections that some stores will respond by scheduling fewer workers on a shift rather than pay for last-minute changes. The rules would weigh store managers down with piles of paperwork to document every change in the work schedule. It's a one-size-fits-all policy for grocery stores and department stores and restaurants and fast food. What's your take?
Well, they're starting from a really bad place, because what we've seen over the last decades is, you know, the power of companies versus employees has risen. Unions have declined. People who show up for Walmart to get a job are given an application for food stamps at the same time. So we've been subsidizing, you know, Sam Walton and his family's profits with food stamps, because they've been really sticking it to workers.
Oh, we don't have any Walmarts here in Seattle.
We don't. But the point stands that this is part of a very large trend in society in which workers have been lost power vis-a-vis employers. So they're starting from a really bad place. And I support it. I support this idea that we give workers some more power. And, you know, this is actually, you know, the comments that have been made by my colleagues on the show about this fight is, you know, it's a good one, but there are bigger ones coming, is absolutely right. Because what we have right now is appears we have a majority of the council and the mayor support this. There's going to be a legislative process where the retailers and everybody can show up and make their concerns. They can fine-tune the legislation. They can test it. They can tweak it later. I think the paid family leave in the future, that's going to be the big fight, because right now that's just being championed by a council member, maybe two, and there's going to be a big pushback. So look for that one to be the big fight, paid family leave for all employees.
Well, the fact that this does only affect these very, very large businesses is kind of key to me, because I think, you know, with the minimum wage battle, the smaller businesses were not immediately impacted, but eventually, you know, everybody was phased into what is still less than a living wage, $15 an hour. Everybody will eventually be making at least that. There's no phase-in process with this for other businesses. And, you know, if you have 50 employees, if you have 100 employees, you're exempted from this. And those are what I would personally consider larger businesses, just in my own work life and, you know, my own experience. So it just seems to me that a law that doesn't affect that many businesses is not the right battle. And you're right that, I'm going to go back on that. I'm not saying it's not the right battle. It should be examined whether there are more important things. And you're right that paid family leave is going to be a big battle. And I think that a lot of times with issues that primarily impact women directly, you do only have a couple of council members, you know, who are women advocating for it. And I'm glad that we have a majority female council now. But I would hope that it wouldn't require an issue directly impacting you as a woman to make it an issue that is important, because we might not always have a majority female council. And it might be one of those issues that just gets pushed forward into the, you know, sort of nonspecific future forever if that's the attitude.
To businesses who feel overburdened, how about this compromise? We get rid of burdensome regulations and we just we tax the rich. We go to national health insurance, giant safety net. Businesses, you can stop taking care of people except for worker safety. Keep the safety rules. Otherwise, go make money and then we'll take your money away and give it to the poor. Does that solve the problem?
It's an awesome idea. And I think that the attempts nationally to try to get that have led to attempts in liberal places like Seattle, progressive places like Seattle, to get an incremental gain and prove it can work. So yes, you know, there's the perfect solution or the great solution, or the all-encompassing solution, and then there's the one you can get in the legislative process in places where you have allies. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing. Great for Seattle. It'll help the rest of the country. But boy, wouldn't it be great if we could do it at a more national scale.
Seattle's current mayor supports this secure scheduling proposal. The city council is probably going to vote on it by mid-September. We'll keep following it here on KUOW's Week in Review. We have a governor to debate. We have a driver's license test to take, and we have a swimmer to, I assume, forgive and love, coming up on the Week in Review. Yeah, is the catchphrase. We'll talk about that in, we'll do a little Lochte in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review with Mike McGinn, Erica C. Barnett, Zeki Hamid. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Governor Jay Inslee debated his election challenger. Republican Bill Bryant opened the debate saying his daddy taught him to leave your campsite cleaner than you found it.
Unfortunately, after 4 years, Governor Inslee has trashed Washington's campsite.
Trash the campsite, huh? Some of Inslee's garbage, according to Bryant, underfunded schools, thousands of prisoners mistakenly released early, screw-ups at the transportation department, and a high state unemployment rate. Jay Inslee was like, geez, depressed much?
Thank you, Bill, for your positive, optimistic opening statement about the vision in our state.
Setting aside who you're voting for, is it fair to hang Washington's troubles on the man in charge, Zeki?
No, I don't think so. There's a legislature involved. There's a lot of other forces involved. I mean, the governor is a clear target at this point. But I don't think it's fair to do that. And by the way, I mean, Bill Bryant really needs somebody to write better jokes for him. That was an awful joke, the whole campfire thing. I mean, campsite thing, that's just cheesy political theater going on here.
And he stole it from Dino Rossi.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that was a Rossi little tidbit. I think it was from Rossi's grandmother who said that you always leave the campsite better than you found it. And that was actually a recycled anecdote. Maybe Bill's, what did he say,
at least we're recycling. It's better than trashing the campsite. Maybe some Republican raccoons got into the trash and scattered it around. Maybe
he just needs a better comedian to come and write some lines for him. So, but yeah, I don't think it's quite fair to do that. But
that's why you put the trash bags on top of your car so the Republicans don't get into it. That's why you do that. Right, go on.
But no, you know, I remember earlier you had asked if, like, what does Bill Bryant have to do?
Yes, I was wondering if imagine you're Bill Bryant's campaign manager. Mm-hmm. What's the strategy?
He needs to become a Democrat. That's pretty much the only way he can do it. Not in this political climate, because it's darned if you do, darned if you don't. You got Trump hanging over you, and if you say I don't like Trump, you lose a bunch of voters. You say I like him, you're going to lose a bunch of voters. It's just not happening for Bill Bryant. And the interesting thing is, Jay Inslee's not really that popular, but he's still leading by 11 points. So you could say, like, hey, you know, somebody could come and take that from him. He's not really that popular. But in this political climate, I just don't see a chance for him.
Well, the funny thing is, I think everybody was, when Bill Bryan announced very early on, I think everybody was sort of like, okay, well, that's nice, but who's the real Republican going to be? And then it was like, it's Bill Bryant.
Why is Bill Bryant such a flawed candidate?
Well, he's relatively unknown outside the Puget Sound region. He was a Seattle Port Commissioner. And I mean, you heard that little clip. He's not the most charismatic speaker. He kind of has this Boehner-esque tone to his speaking. You know, he's just very, very sad about everything. And, you know, isn't it a pity how everything's turned out under Inslee?
If you want to be governor, don't you kind of have to say these are all the ways where your governor's not good enough?
Yeah, I'm just tone policing him. But I agree. You know, if you're the Republican in Washington State and you're running under Trump, it is kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, and he is showing a lot of the same kind of cognitive dissonance that that you have as a Republican in Washington State, because he is ostensibly an environmentalist, although that is highly questionable based on his record. But, you know, he says, I oppose coal trains. But then at the same time, he parrots this Trump line of, I want a moratorium on all regulations. So it's like, well, okay, you oppose coal trains. Well, how do you do that? Oh, you do it through environmental regulations. That's how, as a governor, you would oppose coal trains. But he opposes all regulations, too. So it's he's kind of in a situation where, you know, he's saying things that don't make a whole lot of sense. And Jay Inslee just has opportunity after opportunity to call him on it. And I thought Inslee was really good in that debate. And I say that as someone who is not a particular fan of Inslee's speaking style. I thought he got a lot of good zingers in, and I think he was really on, because he's just kind of, he obviously sees this as a little bit of a cakewalk.
Jay's joke about vision had a real point, too, which is, of course, if you're challenging an incumbent, you have to criticize the incumbent, but you do have to offer an alternative vision. And with Trump at the head of the ticket, telling everybody what the Republican vision for the
country is. Why is Trump Bill Bryant's problem, or Chris Vance's problem, or any that I'm a little skeptical I know it seems like a punditry thing that we in the media, and I'm in the media, we love our Trump stories, and on some level it's so alluring to tie everything to Donald Trump. But is the voter so concerned about what Bill Bryant has to say about Donald Trump? Really?
Let me describe it from a candidate's perspective.
Okay.
Bill has got to impress the public with who he is and what he's about. And on the airways every day is Trump's vision of what being a Republican is. And for Bill to cut through that and present a different vision, you know, he'd have to be an amazing candidate to do that. He would have to be a strong candidate to do that. If you have somebody...
You think voters say, okay, this is what Donald Trump wants. That must be what the Republican candidate for governor wants.
They don't even hear Bill. They don't even hear Bill Bryant. They're left with Republicans.
Yeah, you're looking at that ballot.
They don't even hear him. If you had somebody at the top of the Republican ballot who actually was presenting some vision of the country, or at least appeared competent, Bill could build off of that. He's got to fight the top of the ticket, fight his own weaknesses as a candidate, try to get airtime, and try to point out flaws in Inslee and present a vision. You know, it's just too much for one candidate in these circumstances, and he's certainly not the candidate who could have pulled it off under the best of circumstances. And under the worst of circumstances, he's getting hammered.
I think that a stronger candidate really could make a case against Inslee on a lot of things. You could say, you know, 405. You could point out
405 was on his list, was on Bryant's list of mess ups.
Yeah, I mean it was, but I think you can more. I think a more effective candidate could have more closely tied Inslee to that. I think, you know, the firing of Inslee's transportation secretary Lynn Peterson by the legislature, you know, was a real sign of weakness that a good candidate could have exploited. I think the prisons are the wrong thing to be hitting Inslee on because he wasn't there when that mistake was made, and he was just coming into office when it was discovered. I think McCleary would be a much better example of something that everybody's familiar with that that you could pin on him fairly or unfairly.
This is education underfunding.
The fact that we have not fully funded education in this mm-hmm. state, and that was, you know, a campaign promise that Inslee made and that has not been fulfilled. You know, I'm not into offering free tips to the Republican Party, but you know, next time if you're serious, and Susan Hutchinson, the head of the party here, has said that she is serious because she thinks this is a purple state that could go Republican, then they need to get a more serious candidate and they need to do it earlier.
Okay, so just to recap, you are into providing free advice for Republican candidates, is that right? CisforCrank.com?
I have an hourly rate. You can find my email on my website.
That's political consultant Erica C. Barnett with Mike McGinn and Zeki Hameed. And we've got 6 more candidate debates between now and the general election on November 8th. We'll keep on it for you. Coming up, driving, road rage, Lochte rage. Stay tuned. Live tweeting the show at KUOW. We're kicking sand at each other now here. Zeki Hameed, Erica C. Barnett, Mike McGinn. I'm Bill Radke, and we're following the big news of the week. There's a new Washington driver's license test. It includes questions on distracted driving, marijuana impairment, and road rage. If you come across a road raging driver, you should A, keep your distance, B, not make eye contact, C, not make any sudden movements or gestures that can provoke an angry response. D, slow down and move away from the road rage. E, tear that bastard's arm off and beat him with it. Now, Zeki, you circled E, which I thought was interesting. Why did you make that selection?
Absolutely. They deserve to know that they were wrong.
Uh-huh.
If somebody cuts you off, you got to let them know. Mm-hmm. You know, road rage is going to be seriously the end of me.
Interesting, because you come across pretty thoughtful and mild-mannered.
I know. I have a really good image. Maybe I should run for office.
You'd make an excellent candidate.
I'd make a great candidate. My biggest fear is that I'm driving to the interview of my life. Here it is. This is the biggest job I've ever interviewed for, and I flip somebody off, and it turns out that that's the person who's interviewing me. That is the biggest fear. I think I've probably flipped off, you know, 3-4 people this morning.
Uh-huh.
Statistically,
you've been flipped off by Zeki Hameed, probably.
Probably.
Yeah.
Statistically, probably. And I think probably the rest of the city flips me off back as well. I think I really, really provoke it. So I have a solution.
Okay.
KUOW. You just need to keep listening to the radio,
keep
get
listening.
So engaged.
Yes.
That
you really
care.
Want to be invited back, don't you?
Well, he flipped me off inadvertently right before the show, and he's making up for it.
That's true. But, you know, I have almost a 3-year-old, and when she's with me in the car, I have to just tone it down, and it's such a struggle for me. But then again, not only do I come from the East Coast before I came here, but I come from Jordan in the Middle East. And if you've ever been there and if you've ever driven there, you would really fear for your life. So I'm used to that kind of driving. So come here.
It's more chaotic, but is it also road ragey in Jordan?
Oh, it's everything. It's really everything. You know, I mean, you drive with one hand on the horn and the other hand on the gear, and it's just the way you do it. And everybody screams at each other and cuts each other off. You know, the traffic lights and all the traffic rules, they're just there for suggestion. You know, that's just the way it is. So it's very difficult to, and I'm a very passionate kind of guy, and so behind the wheel, I'm a mess.
Oh. I want to defend honkers in limited circumstances, though. There is an informational honk that it's okay if only so many cars, when the light turns green, only so many cars can get through, and that person who's in front needs to get on it. And if it takes a little honk honk, let's do this thing. Honk away, Seattle.
I gotta say, as someone who does not drive that much, when I do drive, and I grew up in Houston, that's where I learned to drive. So I learned the right-hand turn from the far left lane. That was like, that was my first, you know, my first move that I learned in driving school. So, so I can be a very aggressive driver when I need to be, but I will say in Seattle, I am like the most chill driver, and I'm the opposite as a pedestrian and a cyclist. But when I'm driving, it's like, you know, I made this decision. We all made this decision together to get into our cars today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can see the traffic up ahead. So can you. Like, why are you getting angry? Because there's no way out of this situation. It's like, you know, it's like being on the bus. We really are all in this together. And I think people think that we're not, because you're wrapped in this, you know, in these tons of steel around you. And you think that you're in your own little private room. But we're all on the road together. Like, let's just get through it. Now, if I am in an intersection and somebody informationally honks at me, for example, or cuts me off, I will go ballistic. So it's just a matter of perception. I feel, you know, when I'm a pedestrian, I feel oppressed by cars, and they just, you know, make me so mad. But when I'm in a car, it's like,
let's be clear. As we've heard from these two very thoughtful, reasonable, progressive people, cars and driving are really frustrating. I want you to imagine, like, if your workplace was designed the way our traffic system is designed. Okay, you're sitting at your computer, and every couple of minutes, a big red stop sign comes up, and you just got to sit there and wait. And then you might not get through it, and you get another one, right? Mm-hmm. Your coworkers come up to you, and the only way they can communicate with you is through informational honks or blinking lights.
Well, that's...
Right? You can't even communicate with them. And then to make it even worse in this imaginary office, I just imagine a bicyclist just flies past you periodically, right? You would just go nuts. You would just go crazy. It would just drive you nuts. So we've designed something that's intensely frustrating, and then people get frustrated, and we're sold this vision of the open road driving through California.
In the car. Ads,
in a car ad, the biggest. I'm stealing from Charles Medetti here. You know, the biggest and most deceptive social engineering of our time. That this will actually be fun. So it's crazy. But to answer your question, how I deal with it is, I just keep telling myself, "Hey, we're all going to get where we're going, folks. Here, you want to go ahead of me? Go ahead. We're all
absolutely. I let people in.
Everybody's going to get to their destination.
Wait,
and
you're
we'll
actually
all get
saying that you drive?
Every,
is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Mr. Bike himself?
I drive. And trust me, it is, hey, we're all getting where we're going. And the best way to deal with road rage, walk, take the bus, have a bike ride. It is so much more
I have
satisfying.
A theory, though. I think that the way that we drive may be just the opposite of our personality. Because, Becky, I don't know you well, but you seem very mellow.
I just felt attacked, Erica Barnett.
And Mike and I, in contrast, I think, are very assertive, loud people in our day-to-day lives. But when we get in our cars, it's like our little yoga retreat.
You know, you said that I'm mellow right now. My wife is probably on the floor laughing at this point.
All right. Well, advice from KOW, if you're a road rage type, A, listen to KOW. I heard that. I would say B, listen to KOW podcasts. Okay, that works. C, call a friend on your hands-free phone, right? Just call a friend. D, daydream. E, cut someone off because you were daydreaming. Notice how unreasonable their reaction is. Resolve to never be like that. Agreed?
Sounds good.
Did we make some progress, Eki?
I think we solved it all.
I want you to be safe out there.
I think you made progress, Bill, and I think that's what's really important here.
I hope so. Listener, we're going to get into the next segment here, and it may make you angry. So I just want you to breathe, and then we'll tell you what happened. Stay tuned. It's KOW's Week in Review. This week, America was buzzing about its star Olympic swimmer, Ryan Lochte, who said he and other U.S. swimmers got robbed at gunpoint at a Brazilian gas station. On NBC's Today Show, the hosts puzzled over this apparently fishy story.
I asked him pointedly. I said, there are skeptics who think this story was concocted to hide some kind of other embarrassing behavior, something you didn't want people to know about. Were you with someone you shouldn't be with? He was adamant about that, Hody. Huh. He said, no, that didn't happen. We wouldn't make this story up. We were victims, and we're lucky and happy to be safe.
Wow. I will tell you this. It's interesting to me. Ryan Lochte, I spoke to him about 4 hours after he got into Olympic Village, or 5 hours. You know, they've been out all night long. He's not the kind that can weave a brilliant tale.
Right.
You know, when he hasn't been out all night long, pardon me. But so the fact that he told this story so mellifluously makes me think, well, he could not have invented the whole thing.
Actually, it turns out the swimmers got drunk and stopped at a gas station. And one of them broke down a bathroom door and they peed on the wall. Erica, why have you been following this so closely?
I just think it is like the ultimate example of white privilege. And I actually didn't know who Brian Lochte was. I had to look him up and then I realized he was the Ja guy.
Yeah, he will try to trademark saying Ja.
Is it Ja?
Okay.
Well, so I tend to follow athletes through gossip blogs, so that's how I knew who he was vaguely in the back of my mind. But I just think it's like it's the second I saw the story, people will confirm this. If you, my sources will confirm this for you. I called it. I said there is no way this is true, and
no way he was robbed at gunpoint.
There's no way. The second I saw the story, I said this is not true. He's going to try to spin this that he was in, you know, in a dangerous dark country, and he's, you know, the golden boy American swimmer. And he got robbed, and it's to cover up something. And I just think it's like it's, you know, white American guys go into a country where they are not the majority, and they act like buffoons, and then they try to cover it up. And the Olympic, you didn't play the tape, but the Olympics response was just like it reminded me of every time a guy has done something wrong. Usually it's in a rape case in the U.S. at a college, you know, just saying, boys will be boys. You know, he has such a good career ahead of him. He's one of the best swimmers in the world. And it's almost robotic when you listen to it, you know, just every single excuse you can imagine.
We have a minute and a half left. And in swimming, that's a long time, but not on the week in review. Well, final words?
I cannot add to anything that Erica said. So if you want to see great local athletes in action and of ones of national repute, head down to the Jamal Crawford Pro-Am on Sunday and have a good time locally. You don't got to go to Rio to see great athletes. And it's just my way of saying those big international things, let's do fun stuff in our own backyard.
Zeki, our local athletes, like Hope Solo would never act obnoxious, right?
Yeah, you know, oh God, what a piece of work she is. But the thing is, though, she might be crazy, but she's our crazy. So hashtag lay off Hope Solo. That's my thing. She's our crazy.
Wow. If you're a Husky, you are obnoxious. Wait a minute. You're a Husky? What? Seattle Rain? You're cool.
Yeah, no, I'm cool with her. She said something kind of stupid in the moment of passion right after a really, really tough game. Cut her a break. I mean, I don't remember anybody saying to Richard Sherman he should be kicked off the team. So why are you saying it to Hope Solo?
And we'll see an Olympian. We'll see Sue Bird back with the Seattle Storm soon, too. So we'll go down and watch a WNBA game as well. I'll
and
pitch them,
watch
too.
The Seattle Rain. Hope
are you running for mayor?
And enjoy the sunshine. We got to go. Zeki Hamid, Program Director at Humanities Washington. Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn and host of the podcast, You.
Me.
Us.
Now.
Now. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review.